Oh boy, your crock pot is one of the most toxic things in your home, and here's why. It's probably lead in the lining, right? Ooh, all sorts of toxins in the liner of a crock pot. Cadmium, aluminum, mercury, arsenic.
Hey, flush the toilet!
Too busy to flush!
Hey everybody, welcome to Too Busy to Flush. I'm JR.
And I'm Molly.
The Magnificent.
I don't even remember. Golly, you guys refer back to stuff that we record and I'm like, I don't even remember what that was about. I mean, I appreciate it. It means you don't know me well, but JR must have been the original one to say it and I don't remember the context.
Totally. I don't remember calling you the Magnificent at all.
That's not the sort of thing JR would say about his wife.
It's true. So
anyway,
this is your first time joining us. Thank you so much for being here. We don't know what we're going to talk about, and that's on purpose because Molly and I have been married for 15 years.
Is this a pop quiz? Yes.
No, it's not a pop quiz.
Labor Day will be 16.
Okay.
I just am working on my mental math here. Yeah.
Right. 16 years, we've got 4 children. 13 through 5, a boy and 3 girls. And we live on 2.5 acres in Montana. I'm an audio engineer. And Molly is awesome at everything she does. So it doesn't matter what she does. Anyway, so we live life and we raise kids in a world where people are weird and hard. And this is just us talking about child rearing, news items, things we're engaging with, and how to apply those things to life, marriage.
Food we like.
And yes, we talk about a lot of food, don't we?
Yeah, don't forget about the food.
Don't forget about the food. We are big foodies. Are we having salmon for dinner?
We are.
What topping are you putting on the salmon?
I'm going to do the one the kids love the most.
Which is
a layer of mayonnaise and then McCormick, what is it called? Maple... Now I can't remember exactly what the topping is called. Let me quickly Google McCormick maple seasoning. Anyway, Costco used to sell it. They don't sell it anymore, so I buy it in little tubs at Winco. Smokehouse maple.
Smokehouse maple.
So you guys, if you're looking for an almost fail-proof, delicious way to make salmon, you just put a layer of... My mom does a little, she invented the recipe. She puts a layer of the smokehouse maple straight on the salmon, and then she does a layer of mayonnaise, and then she does more smokehouse maple. I get lazy and I just do a layer of mayonnaise and then a layer of smokehouse maple.
Man, it must be really lazy that you can't just do an extra shake.
I just,
wow.
I didn't even occur to me. And just now as I was thinking of it, I was like, I don't know why I don't do that. But you guys, JR does not like mayonnaise. We are a divided house.
Fan.
We are a divided household. Half of our house doesn't like it. And I
Which one's the one you put? You asked me for one a little bit on my sandwich the other day. I'm starting to come around to a little bit of it. Is it Miracle
Whip
or mayonnaise?
Mayonnaise,
yeah.
But.
Because mayonnaise is made from eggs, right?
It is.
Okay, I'm starting to come around a little bit to mayonnaise on sandwiches, like a good cold cut sandwich.
So because I like to control the quality of ingredients in the food that we eat, and I'm on board with the train of thought that believes that seed oils are one of the worst things to put into your body, in every area except for our chip consumption, we eat a lot of tortilla chips, and they are fried in seed oils all day long. Because not frying them in seed oils is crazy expensive. But other than that, I have pretty much ruthlessly eliminated seed oils. And by which I mean canola and safflower, you know, the cheap bulk clear oils that you buy in the store. I've pretty much eliminated those from our diet. Mayonnaise, at the rate that Titus and Elise go through it, plus putting it on the salmon... a couple times a month, and we are a big enough family that we eat 2 fillets of salmon on salmon nights, which we have a couple times a month, would drive our grocery bill up noticeably on a monthly basis. And so I make my own mayonnaise, and I have started doctoring it. Now that I've gotten down the basic recipe, it actually is skewing a little bit Miracle Whippy, because a normal mayonnaise, Miracle Whip tastes the way it does because it's sweetened. It's got like this tangy sweet flavor that a straight mayonnaise doesn't have. But when I make, so I make homemade mayonnaise, it's very, very easy. You just put it in a quart wide mouth ball mason jar and you put an egg, and you want a good quality egg. So, you know, I use a fresh egg that hasn't been refrigerated. An egg, I think it's a cup of oil, and I use either avocado oil or light olive oil. You don't want to use a dark olive or an extra virgin olive oil because it just has a too much of an olivey bite to it and it overpowers the rest of the mayonnaise flavor. Although there are purists who say, well, you should get over that and just like eat the olive oil mayonnaise because that's the best way to make it. It's the healthiest way for you. Anyway, there's a whole mayonnaise debate world about how to make mayonnaise healthy. But I use avocado oil or light olive oil. I go back and forth. And then I use a squirt of regular just yellow mustard. I do a sprinkle of salt, but I'm trying to picture in my mind how much I use. It's probably about a quarter of a teaspoon, maybe a little bit more than that. About the same amount of garlic powder, and then about half a teaspoon of sugar. And I've found that when I combine all of those, either lemon juice or apple cider vinegar. I go back and forth between those, but you have to have some sort of acid in it to help with the emulsification and the flavor. And that makes us about, it whips up into, I don't know, about 3/4 of a jar worth of, so just under a pint worth of mayonnaise. And you have to, because it doesn't have any stabilizers in it, like a store-bought mayonnaise, you have to keep it refrigerated pretty quickly after you make it, or it splits and it's just like a weird greasy mess.
Well, which is funny because I like all of those things separately by themselves. Yeah. But for some reason, I don't know if when it's the texture or the flavor, it's like, eh. But I also don't like egg salad. I'm not a fan of egg salad at all, but I love eggs.
And you also, what was the other thing I was just going to say that you don't care for? Anyway, I don't know. I forgot what I was going to say. Do you like deviled eggs?
No.
Which is just the egg yolks mixed. You don't really like hard-boiled eggs in general, though. That's no. The thing, though. You I'll don't like hard. So egg salad is hard-boiled eggs, so you don't like hard-boiled egg products.
There you go. Yeah. Who's with me, guys? Any other egg haters out there? Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Hard-boiled egg haters. I forgot to mention this at the beginning of the show. Because we don't know where we're going to go, there's a time-stamped roadmap in the show notes, so you can check that out.
Yeah.
For your stuff.
For your listening enjoyment, in case you want to see if there's anything worthwhile for the next 45 minutes and cut it short and move on with your life right now.
Yes. Okay.
Anyway.
Right. I had, what was it? I had something I was going to talk to you about on the show.
Okay, well, you're remembering that. I have been
It was related to a community thing, discussion thing.
Did it have to do with our church life group discussion? That was, okay.
I think so.
Okay. Anyway, well, I have something I've been saving to tell you about on the show since I read this in the kids' school. And it actually segues perfectly from talking about mayonnaise, funny enough. Do you know the history of Caesar salad?
Oh, no, I told you to write this down. I don't
you
know the history
did.
Of Caesar
okay.
salad.
Caesar salad.
Speaking of food.
Yeah. So in school, you guys are now tracking with us.
Do you capitalize Caesar?
Yes, you do, because it's a first name.
So it's named after Caesar.
No, I'm getting to that. So you guys, we, as you guys know, we just finished World War I, and now this week in school, I have the kids studying the Roaring Twenties, and then today was the stock market crash, which I had to I didn't get one-on-one time with Titus. But
I heard you talking to Elise about
Lily. What is the stock market? I was trying to teach Lily in very basic terms, what is the stock market? And how do you explain to her? So, you know, how do you explain?
You did a very good job of explaining the stock market.
Oh, thank you. So what I did, you guys, is I told her different ways that you can use money to start a business. You can save up all your money, like if you're going to open a Walmart. Not a Walmart, a store like Walmart. You can save up all your money until you can pay for the building and pay for all this stuff and pay for your employees until you make enough money that you have the cash flow to pay them. Or you can get a loan from a bank individually and you can do that. Or you can seek investment from people and give them a portion of ownership in the company. And I divided a square up into, I think I did like 25 little squares. And I said each of these squares represents how much money you put into the company. And then how much money you get out for every $100 that you make. And I said, the stock market is kind of like a massive version of that, where you can buy a tiny bit of a company. And because you can't just walk up to Apple and say, I'd like to own a tiny bit of your company. There's this clearinghouse that's in New York City and you can buy tiny bits of a company. And I said, but it gets a little bit tricky because you get real overly excited about how much that company's worth. And it's kind of a subjective thing at some level. So I said, if there's one cookie left from the batch of cookies that Elise made with Grammy last week, chocolate chip cookies that were absolutely loaded with chocolate, and you two girls both want the cookie, it is a little bit subjective how much you think it's worth. And maybe one of you think it's worth washing a window, and maybe one of you think it's worth washing four bathrooms for it. And Lily was like, yeah, I would wash four bathrooms for a cookie. And I was like, no, you wouldn't. Also, do you really objectively think that a cookie is worth cleaning four bathrooms? Or do you think that maybe just in the heat of the moment and really wanting that cookie and knowing there's only one, you're willing to do maybe more than it's worth and you get a little bit overly enthusiastic about it. And then you get to the point where you finally get the cookie and you're like, well, that wasn't worth cleaning four bathrooms. Well, that was a very, very simplified version of explaining the stock market crash of 29. we have this, one of the textbooks that we have for school is a American history cookbook. So it's got a couple of paragraphs, well, actually a couple of pages of explanation about an era of history. And then it has several recipes that you can make to enjoy foods from that era of history. So the three recipes with the Roaring Twenties, which just to give you guys a very brief review, because I assume that you're all very educated people and you know what the Roaring Twenties is. But the Roaring Twenties, we came out of World War I and America was in a pretty good place economically. We had not experienced the physical destruction that the rest of the Allies experienced during World War I. And we were on the verge of all of this crazy amount of growth economically, as well as in industry. And we've got cars now. And musically, we've got jazz. And that jazz is converting into dancing. And so there are, you know, all these dances like the Lindy Hop and the Charleston were invented then. And women wore shorter dresses and tighter dresses and danced more crazily than they had, and they started getting promiscuous and wearing lots of makeup, and just there was this kind of collect. And candy bars were invented: the Babe Ruth bar, the Reese's peanut butter bar. There were a couple of others that were invented during that era. Baseball, we've got Babe Ruth shattering records and winning hearts, and what else was going on in that era? And then we have suffrage, women getting the vote, and prohibition, which was basically the same group of women saying, hey, women need protection and women have rights. And all of these men are drinking away their family's money and then coming home and beating their kids and their wives. And so let's ban alcohol. And then so not only did speakeasies arise during that era, but so did cocktail parties, because people weren't going to bars to drink. They were drinking at home and they were masking the not great flavor of the homemade liquor with juices and other flavorings. And then they invented finger food during that time. So you could hold your cocktail and your cigarette in one hand and eat your finger food like an open-faced, tiny, bite-sized sandwich or celery stuffed with blue cheese in the other hand. And Titus thought that was funny. He latched onto the invention of finger food during the Roaring Twenties, but also during Prohibition in California, Californians would go across the border to Tijuana to drink because alcohol was still being legally created in Mexico. And there was a restaurant owner named Cesar Cardini, who one day was his restaurant called the Tijuana Restaurant in 1924. I'm reading now from a website. Was a hotspot for celebrities and American travelers who would cross the border in order to drink and party. And he started running out of food at his restaurant. So he threw together this salad that was just like random stuff. Romaine lettuce, some olive oil, some raw eggs, some garlic, some Parmesan cheese, some Worcestershire sauce. And he named it after himself, the Cesar salad. And it stuck. And I mean, there's different versions of the story, but basically it's saying this dude named Cesar invented this salad.
He was Mexican.
He owned a restaurant in Tijuana. And yes, so it is capitalized because it's his name, and it should technically be pronounced the Cesar salad because that's how you say
that's funny.
Caesar, which is funny because it's a staple in Italian restaurants, but it's not, it wasn't invented in Italy at all. It was invented in Mexico during Prohibition. And we are huge Caesar salad eaters in this family. Titus will literally drink Caesar salad dressing.
So what you're saying is one of the number one salads in America is Mexican. Like, Mexican food is the best, you guys. Caesar salads are Mexican.
Yeah, and it came out of Prohibition.
That's amazing.
Pretty crazy, huh? So anyway. So he did not actually use mayonnaise, but he used raw egg. And a traditional Caesar dressing is similar to mayonnaise. It's oil, raw egg, and lemon juice and garlic. And if they make it in an Italian restaurant, which now I have to rethink, you know, thinking about how authentic it is when they're making it like this in an Italian restaurant. But they would whip it with a whisk in a bowl, and then they add the other toppings into the bowl on top of the salad dressing that they've just whisked together. They've hand emulsified it, and then they toss the other toppings with it over the top of
so Cesar dressing. Didn't get it from an Italian.
According to legend, he was running out of stuff on his menu and had all of these Americans, drunk Americans, still wanting food.
You know, we're going to have a listener pipe up in Telegram that we're
wrong.
They're going to have like more detail on this whole thing, and they're going to flesh it out more.
Or they'll tell us we're wrong. Because you guys are speaking of telling us that we're wrong, which I appreciate. Our Telegram listeners are not shy about that, and it's great. And if you don't know what, I don't think you talked about what Telegram is.
No, I usually save that for the end of the show.
Okay. So if you carry, no, you talk.
No, you talk. Okay, I'll talk. Molly talks the whole show.
I'm going to take a sip of coffee.
Our Telegram, we have a private Too Busy to Flush chat group on the app Telegram. And the link for that is in the show notes. And we've got, probably got a dozen or couple dozen members that are pretty active on there. And then we've got upwards of 65, 66, something like that, total members. That's what Telegram is.
Yeah.
So, it's the number one way to interact with us. I mean, it's lots of activity throughout the week.
That's a great ongoing activity. And
I think it's super fun.
We've become friends.
We have become friends. We've made a lot of new relationships there.
And so we're all celebrating together the fact that Maggie had a baby this week.
Which is congratulations, Maggie.
Awesome.
Super rad. And I think, hang on, let me open it up, because they were just discussing before we started recording, name of said baby is Thomas William. So that's awesome. Congratulations.
Nice, strong name.
Welcome to the end of the world, Thomas.
I mean, maybe not. You never
I saw a meme, Ski Magazine posted a picture of a mostly melted mountainside and said, hate to break the news to you, but this is what our ski areas could look like. And they said by 2050, we're going to be like 2 months shorter on the ski season.
Because of global warming.
The trends continue. No, they didn't say global warming. They attributed it to, what do you call
El Nino?
What do you call exhaust gases?
Greenhouse gases?
They had a different word for it, but all carbon, of the carbon emissions. All the emissions. They attributed like because of emissions. It's like, well,
did you know that the the ice levels in the North Pole are actually growing. Do you remember the Coca-Cola ads with the polar bear that like doesn't have any ice left? The depth of ice in the North Pole has actually gotten, despite so-called global warming, has actually gotten deeper in recent years, which, you know, just all the narratives and the fear-mongering. Be a good steward of the world that God gave you and try to be savvy and wise about how you be a good steward, and don't go overboard on anything. Anything way overboard is probably bad for you. But we started mentioning with Telegram. So look forward to if any of you guys have corrective information about the history of Caesar salad. Also, Deke, I was commented that last week we were discussing an AI video that had been created with Biden talking about instituting a draft. And Deke felt like he needed to clarify that it wasn't just some random person trying to fool people, but that was actually created by a former military special ops guy who wanted to make a point about how dangerous AI could be. So he didn't create it to be devious. He created it to make a point about how tremendously bad AI videos can be.
That's what I was trying to remember was related to AI. I read an article recently from a music industry veteran who was discussing the oncoming advent of AI music being in our top 40 charts all over the radio, etc. Not created by necessarily an artist, but by somebody who's just going to make some AI music and try to make a living on it. And you're going to miss out on something. And then I've got other people in my network too that are not adamantly opposed to artificial intelligence, but they are opposed to what is probably going to happen with artificial intelligence, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's going to replace a lot of human creative efforts, including music. So what had happened was this particular music industry veteran had said where he thinks things are going is into the live world, because you have two things going on. The first one is you actually have a group of humans creatively and emotionally inputting into this musical creation, and you're not going to get that with AI music, and you'll probably could very well sense it when we listen to it, but I don't know, maybe not, because there's a lot of, like, even I make quote unquote synthetic music. I mean, I'm making music out of sound waves and sine waves and stuff, but the electronic thing. But the other thing you have there is you have a live connected human live experience going on. So he's like, he was basically saying it can be so expensive to get into a studio and record an album and put it out there when you're going to be competing with, I mean, there's already 15 million tracks a day going up on Spotify. You're already competing with all this synthetic AI. Yeah. You're already competing with all this synthetic AI music. So why not just go out, do your show, record your show, and then just put that out. And that might have, so that's kind of where he's thinking things are going to kind of shift
that,
a little bit. He
thinks that there will be, even on a recorded show that you would put online, there would be some intangible, authentic human experience that can't be recreated with AI.
Yes.
I can see that. When you were talking, I was thinking that just live music in general, that would be kind of where it's at. And while you were saying that, I was starting to think about two things. One, oh man, why am I even going to say this out loud? I'm going to open my mouth and then on Telegram in a few minutes, I'm going to regret this. I'm thinking about Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, which is, you know, and as much as, remember that Gospel Coalition article that we just laughed so hard at because he was comparing it to a worship experience?
Which is not a new thought. There was a book that came out in the late aughts called Body Piercing Saved My Life.
Yeah.
And the author was a Rolling Stone artist or a Rolling Stone author. And he did a deep dive on the Christian music scene and ended with ended with discussing worship and comparing it to I'm quoting here, an orgasmic experience.
Yeah.
Like it's like a spiritual thing, which is synonymous with something else. And it's weird. It was a weird book.
Yeah. I think it's still on our bookshelves. I feel like we need to,
it was interesting.
I feel like we need to curate some of our bookshelves.
It was interesting
because
but
for
it was weird.
Kids who are going to start picking stuff up like that, reading it.
I mean, that's not going to necessarily, there's nothing graphic in that book. That was, but it was a take that only a secular person who, it's a hypersexualized culture, that's what you see and that's what
and
you.
And he's hearing Jesus is my boyfriend sort of music.
Yeah. And he's, you know.
So, but there is something you couldn't have just a speaker playing at a stadium or even, a show like we went to with the Lucky Valentines with 30 people in the crowd, no matter what size or venue, unless you're going to a dance thing, right? Like a club. Just to, you know, have beats washing through your body and dance and whatever. You go for the live experience of it because there is a human connection element that you miss.
Even the electronic stuff is because of the live experience. The reason like Burning Man is such a huge deal is because you've got all of these weird people in a community experiencing the same thing together as people.
That's true.
Like they've got that going for them.
So it feels like, I mean, even with how much, you know, I'm way out of my my pay grade
talking about this.
No, but that, you know, when you think about how much Spotify and Apple pay artists,
which is
almost nothing. Although Top House was saying, because, you know, we're big fans of Top House, they were saying that they don't have a label. They produce their music and they put it directly onto Apple and Spotify and stuff, and they said you would be surprised at how helpful it actually is for you to stream our music.
Because
we don't have a label in between, and we do actually see financial benefit that's not negligible from you listening to our music.
They've changed Spotify. It was a big rage, like probably about a month ago. Spotify changed their rules, and if you get less, I don't remember the exact number, but if you have less than 1,000 streams on a song, you're not going to get paid for it at all.
Wow.
So, and even then you're only going to get paid.
That's
like,
kind of YouTube's, it accrues, the more views you have, the more you get
paid.
But
you've got to be, to make any sort of meaningful money out of things, you've got to be 10,000 streams a song and you got to get on a playlist or get something. Cause how long is it going to take? Like
somebody like
somebody like me in my electronic world to build up a fan base of 1,000 people or 1,200 people. Yeah. That's really good. That kind of audience could actually have an impact. They'll be buying your merch. They'll be listening to your stuff regularly. They'll be coming to your shows. It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a long time. You know, you're competing with 15 million other tunes a day.
What I'm saying though is putting AI music out there is not necessarily going to impact the real artists because it seems like most real artists are making their money now. Unless they're very big, is with live stuff, with the merch sales. I mean, that's what Top House was saying anyway, is we make our money with you coming to our shows, with you buying our merch and, you know, that sort of thing. And you're not going to do that with AI music. There's no live music experience. There's no merch, that sort of thing. The other thing I was thinking about is I didn't listen to this thoroughly. So, again, I'm talking out of my pay grade, but I have our kids watch World Watch, which is World News's video news clips for kids, students. And yesterday, I make the kids write summaries of some of the top article or top pieces that they listen to. Titus wrote down that there was a discussion about AI with worship music. And I did see enough of the discussion after the fact, because I was skimming back through it with Elise, to see they were interviewing a worship leader, and he said the AI worship music is never going to replace worship leaders in a church. He's like it's just not possible because of that human to human connection in a church setting. We're leading people to worship in a relational way, and I don't It's not a question that I had thought about before. Oh, are we going to ever have AI worship leaders? But he just, because he made it so definitive, this is a relational thing. You can't, by definition, have AI worship leaders. It does make me wonder, though, and I'm maybe, okay, here's an assignment for you people out there who are more savvy than we are. Like, when we were in Kalispell last weekend with our friends, Kim, who teaches at a small Christian high school, she was talking about how kids are using ChatGPT to write essays and papers now, and there are whole teacher resources now for helping to detect a ChatGPT paper, and it's surprisingly hard. But Kim, without batting an eye, said, well, I used ChatGPT to write a sample essay today for my kids. I told ChatGPT I want an essay on this topic. I wanted to have an intro of this many sentences. And she gave it very specific parameters, and it spat out a well-reasoned, factually correct essay for her to use as a sample for her students. So there are people out there who are doing this that I've never used ChatGPT. I'm such a Luddite. Like,
I think I downloaded it here on my iPad to do something with, and I never ended up using it for anything, but it's just sitting here.
So I would be super curious if the quality of a worship song that ChatGPT could write.
Oh, man.
Because, you know, like, for two reasons. One is, you know, you ask ChatGPT for a picture of a World War I soldier. Is this just Gemini or is it Chat, which is the Google one, right?
Gemini.
But ask, so that if you guys aren't following the news, Google now has an AI thing, and you ask it for, and it's,
it did. They pulled it down. Super broken, you guys.
Because it was literally unable to produce images of white people. So you'd ask for a picture of a World War I soldier, and it would be like an Asian soldier in a U.S. Outfit. George Washington was depicted as black. He was literally unable to produce a picture. And because what you feed AI, it reflects human biases. And so what it's being fed is basically woke material, and it's spitting out woke material. But I'm super curious, could you say, ChatGPT, write me a worship song to the Christian God, not just to a generic God, but to the Christian God, talking about oceans, using water as a metaphor, and specifically celebrating the Trinity.
Oh, man.
You know, like, create some really specific parameters and see if ChatGPT could come up with something that would pass, like, City of Light, you know, Getty, Shane and Shane, whatever must. I don't even care. Hillsong. See if it'll pass Hillsong muster.
I just pulled up ChatGPT to, like, punch in something, and I haven't even signed up for it yet, so I'm not going to do it now.
But okay.
No, that'll be funny. And then those of you on Telegram, do that and then post what you get. Like, post your seeds, like what you use to feed
for your parameters.
And then post what you end up getting.
And then you could trip it up and say, could you write a Muslim worship song?
Oh, man.
Because there's no such.
Or Mormon. No, what's interesting about that, Molly, is I do believe some of the stuff coming out of the mainstream stuff is generic enough. It kind of repeats itself, and it's not that unique.
Would you say generic? You mean generic Christian worship music right now, or ChatGPT stuff?
Sorry, generically, it's got generic metaphors, kind of generic songwriting, generic words, generic all that stuff. Like, unless you change the melody, one you could almost interchange lyrical content. Is just not that deep, and it's all kind of it's not, well, I'm gonna compare it to this. Now take a singer songwriter that brings a lot of life experience and expresses the world and their experience and what their understanding is in their music.
Yeah.
You don't get that with worship music. It's talking about theology, it's talking about those sorts of things.
I don't know, because I think that a good good worship music, and I'm using the word worship music very, very generally to talk about the music that we sing in church during the singing portion of a worship service. And so by that, I'm also thinking about hymns. There are entire homeschool books, not just homeschool books, but homeschool moms like to use them, about the history of a hymn. And so, you know, who wrote It Is Well With My Soul? I can't think off the top of my head. It was Isaac Watts. Anyway, whoever wrote It Is Well With My Soul, he wrote that in the wake of finding out that his entire family had died. You can't write something with that rich and deep of lyrics without, sorry, I hear yelling from upstairs, and I'm trying to determine if the kids are home or if Faith, who was sleeping on the couch when I came downstairs, has need of us. I don't hear any more yelling, but there's a lot of thumping. The kids are home. But, you know, he wrote It Is Well With My Soul in the wake of a deeply personal experience. And it doesn't have the singer-songwriter personal narrative in it, but the depth of experience of who God is, for sure, is the result. I just Googled who wrote It Is Well With My Soul, and I got Audrey Assad. No, she didn't write it. Horatio Spafford.
Chat GPT fail or
Google fail.
Internet fail.
That's literally just probably she's the most common.
She's probably sung the most, best version.
The most hits on it. But anyway.
My favorite version is the Bethel one.
I know. That's not even a true version, though.
I know, but just it's the melodies, the lyricism.
But, you know, Amazing Grace.
Just saying.
Amazing Grace comes from a deeply personal experience of realizing. I mean, we're talking about a human trafficker, a slave dealer.
So do you think GPT would, if you asked it to write a Christian song from human experience, that would be interesting?
I don't know. Too. You write a Christian worship song from the perspective of Tim Tebow, you know.
Someone who lost, I mean, it's being fed with information. So someone who lost a loved one recently.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think a Christian worship song from the perspective of Tim Tebow would be pretty interesting, too. Jesus is my champion. Like, throw a winner. I don't know.
What happens if they're actually really good?
That's really interesting. I don't know. I mean, I guess that comes back to saying, isn't it amazing that God built into the human brain the capacity to create a machine that can reflect glory and worship back to the Savior.
I was musing on that exact, the ability for humans to create, and the fact that we're always trying to, we're not. So the Tower of Babel, they wanted to build a tower to get to the heavens.
Without God.
Without God. And so basically, like, we believe, this is loose, we believe there's a God. We want to get to heaven without him. We don't need him to get there. Now we're creating all of this AI, all of this technology to be God. We're now creating new life, new technological life. It's just, it's like this weird perversion of the creation.
Is, but also there's nothing new under the sun.
No. And you're at the same time, you're not, are you really actually truly creating out of nothing, or are you simply subcreating from pre-existing components?
Well, you're absolutely subcreating.
Exactly.
There's no such thing.
So it's like
creation,
there's no
ex nihilo apart from.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that, like, where humanity is always trying to attain that next thing.
It know? Is the
they built the Titanic to be the greatest human achievement on the planet or whatever, and now it's like, nope, now it's technology.
No, yeah, but I mean that's. It is the lie in the garden, right? You shall be like God. And that, I mean, literally, there is nothing new. Speaking of the lie of the garden, the serpent in the garden, I'm working my way through the Jesus Storybook Bible with Faith. And I don't know, little five-year-old brains just latch onto things. We read about the temptation in the wilderness. And here's Jesus, because the Jesus Storybook Bible doesn't strictly follow the second commandment, if you interpret it in that way. And here's Jesus with a red and white striped serpent next to him out in the desert. And this, you know, I explained to Faith, the serpent is representing Satan, who is tempting Jesus. And Faith is like, wait a second, that's not the same serpent as at the beginning of the book. And she flips back. And sure enough, the serpent in Genesis of the Jesus Storybook Bible is blue. And she's like, this one is blue and this one is red and yellow. It's not the same serpent. And I was like, I mean, the snake probably died somewhere between like creation and Jesus coming. Like, we know this was a period of thousands of years. Satan is coming into the snake, but we don't actually know that it wasn't a serpent in Matthew. You know, it's she... just embodying, you know, representing Satan tempting the second Adam. But I was like, man, how did you, we read that probably a month ago. Like, how do you remember this?
Side note, on the way to judo last night, it was just, I had just Elizabeth and Faith, and we were playing, we always play music on the way to judo. Whoever's sitting kind of in the front seat ends up running the DJ booth. And we've now, instead of listening to the same playlist over and over, or adding three songs to the playlist mm-hmm. over and over, we just kind of go around the car and everybody picks yep. the next song. And Faith was insistent. Faith wanted a song. Faith wanted a song called The Best. And she's like, The Best. And she's singing it. And so she knows the words. She's singing this song. We can't figure out what she wants. She's like, it's the one, it's the version. It's got a white cover and it's got a painted hand on it.
Oh my gosh.
And we're like, what? So like Elizabeth is like, I have no idea. Trying to figure out. And Faith is adamant. It's like, it's got a white hand. It's got a white cover and a painted hand on it. That's the one. That's the
and
best song.
It's called
song
The
I
Best.
Want. It's called The Best. So she was singing it. So Lily was like, about 5 minutes later, Lily's like, oh, I got it. Faith, this is it, isn't it? Yeah, that's it. And it had a white picture with a painted hand on it.
Oh my
and you're
gosh.
Just like, your memory, kid.
Yeah.
But Molly,
but she will take my iPad and she's halfway through her teach your child to read book. Mm-hmm. We're on like lesson 56 out of 100.
She reads well for five.
She reads pretty well for a five-year-old, but she has been operating my iPad with her own Apple Music playlist for 2 years now. Completely.
It's true.
She can do all the functions. She knows how to add music to her playlist without any input from me whatsoever. She just figured it out by pushing buttons, and she will find, she's like cruises Apple Music where as much as she can with you having it locked down. It's usually suggested music mm-hmm. from stuff that she likes, and she adds stuff to her playlist that it's wild.
Lily found that song by, she's like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. I just punched in the lyrics that she was singing.
Oh, she, in Apple Music you can do that?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Found the songs with the lyrics, so I didn't know you could do that either. Lily was kind of excited about that.
Yeah, oh man. Kids and technology, I tell ya. It's a crazy world out there.
You guys, I'm just drinking water right now. I've had my coffee for the day, had my green tea for the day. I haven't had any chai, but I'm feeling content right now in my belly, and chai with milk in it, just like, well, that could put me over the edge.
I am drinking a mocha because I had green tea this morning during my phone call, and now I'm finally enjoying my daily mocha. Let's see, how much time do we have left? Like 15 minutes?
I don't know. The time is all screwed up because we had that technical kerfluffle that nobody knows about because they didn't hear it. I edited it out.
So you guys, I have two things about cats to tell you.
Ooh, fun.
No, two or three. Did we discuss the cat with the bird last week? Can't remember when we recorded. So you guys, we did. I'm pretty sure we talked about, we have a cat door that my father-in-law installed, and we discovered pretty quickly on that one of our two cats likes to bring animals that she has killed or has caught through the cat door, and it locks going both directions. And so we try to keep it locked for, like, they can go out, because our cats, like most cats, like to go, they wake up early in the morning, they go out and hunt, and then they come back at breakfast time. And, so we have it so they can go out, so I don't have to get up in the middle of the night to let them out and try to keep it locked for them coming in. But with all the in and out, because it's our main door that we use also, it jiggles open. And So then occasionally, and I forget to check it. And so last Wednesday during one of my Canavox calls, there's this big kerfluffle. I'm in our school room, which is around the corner from our main kitchen dining area, and all the other kids are in there, and Titus starts yelling, and all of a sudden Minerva the cat chases a very much alive bird into the school room where I am on a call, on a Zoom call, and the bird like lands in a bookshelf right next to our window, and the cat climbs the screen up the window to get to the bird. And so I'm not sure if I muted myself or not in retrospect on that call. I might not have. I'm like, there's a bird in the house. I'm going in the basement to continue on my call. I hope the bird's not here in an hour when I come upstairs.
If anything, the ladies loved it.
Well, nobody said anything. So I'm wondering if I was muted. So I checked the cat door. It was at a point where she could come in and out. So she had easily come in with a bird that she had not killed yet. While I was on the call, JR and Titus opened some windows and chased the bird, and it eventually flew out a window. It ended fine. I had my local Canavox group. So I have a group of ladies sitting around my dining table on Monday night, and I get a text from Addie. And I'm like,
she told you about it?
Yeah. I was wondering. I have my phone next to me, right? Just so I can keep track of time, because the only clock in the house is on the oven behind me. Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to make sure that we're operating in a timely manner. And I'm like, why is she texting me? She's sitting two people over from me. And she's like, there's a mouse on your counter. And I'm picturing the mouse on our island, like eating the chocolate cake that I've set out for ladies. But it was on the counter against the wall right next to our oven, and it was apparently hanging out behind the oven and walking along the backsplash. And she I have this very distinct memory of my whole like my face going hot and just like this like feeling like I might throw up, like what? And I like did these big eyes at her, and she's like, uh-huh. And I was like, so I texted JR and I'm like, hey, Addie says there's a mouse on our counter. Can you please come deal with it? And I neglected to say, can you please come try to deal with it discreetly? And so he comes out and's like, there's a mouse on our counter. And
Addie's like, well, I tried to say that without raising
awareness.
So all
the other gals are like, what? And I think most of the others are like, yeah, we like everybody except one of the other gals who is there owns chickens and just knows, or has like been country enough, and I'm putting country in scare quotes, but has been kind of country enough that they're like, oh yeah, it happens. And then one gal was like, I'm sorry, what? And so JR goes and gets a mouse trap and sets it right where Addie has said that the mouse has been like walking across our backsplash. And I'm trying to carry on a very serious conversation about like womanhood and how do we understand like what is the role of women in the world and all these things. And everyone, my back is to it, and everyone else around our table is looking straight past me and watching this mouse come out and check out the peanut butter on the mousetrap and then go back. Come out and get a little bit closer to it and go back. And at one point they're like, it's like hanging over the trap, like leaning way out over it. And then all of a sudden, and I was like, I think we're done here.
I was in the bedroom. I was in the bedroom when all that went down, and I heard the mousetrap go, and I heard every single woman hoot and holler around the table and start cheering and clapping. And oh, it was
funny.
Man.
So Titus came and set it back on our back deck, because it was, and it was like all in on the trap. Like, it wasn't just its head was caught. It was like halfway down its body. It was all in when it decided to finally go for it. But anyway, keeping me humble for, you know, just over and over. Like, yes, I have a live mouse. And we have never had a mouse problem in our house. We have in our garage. So I feel quite confident. And I've never found traces of mouse work anywhere in our cabinets or anything. So I feel fairly confident that it had to have been a fairly recent thing that Minerva had brought that mouse in the house, and it was just getting its bearings and whatnot.
I think that cat sometimes is more problem than she's worth.
She's so cute though. So
you guys, Molly says
cats.
That But they sit there and hold her until she starts growling. And then they hold her. They see how long they can hold her before, like, she goes claws out at their face. That's a good time for them.
It is, actually.
Torturing the cat.
He's not lying. Three of us have scars on our faces from that cat. And when I say us, I mean, like, us. I'm in that group. But, okay, so that is... I actually also in my Cane of Vox, and I'm going to Portland this weekend to teach at a high school, middle school and high school event for Cane of Vox. And I've been playing around in my mind with a metaphor concerning cats. And I don't think I've ever tried it out with y'all out there before. So I'm going to try it out right now and see what you think. But so my assigned topic is to talk about hookup culture with homeschooled middle school and high school students, which I'm not sure exactly how the topics came to be chosen, but it seems like a funny one to me to be, you know, I have a homeschooled seventh grader, and the topic of don't go have random drunk sex has yet to come up in our home. And I feel like it won't for quite a while. You know, I mean, the kids drink it. Like, there's so many steps that he would need to get to in order to even have that be a conversation we have to have. I know that it...
Well, he turned 13 in December.
Yeah.
And I've been eyeballing him as he's around different girls and things, and he seems totally oblivious to them still.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Yeah, but... so anyway, I'm trying to think through how do I broach this topic with kids that I don't know where they're at, like how much their parents have taught them. I mean, it's not like the subject of this workshop is a secret. So they know what they're signing up for when they sign up to come to this workshop. And hopefully they'll have a little bit of an idea. But the whole thing about Cane of Vox, when we talk about topics like this, or when we talk about divorce, or when we talk about same-sex marriage, or we talk about cohabitation, living together, any topics surrounding sexual ethics starts with a natural law understanding of what is the design. And so here I'm going to insert a conversation about cats before I insert a conversation about sex. And I will start by talking about how when we got our cats, our youngest, Faith, who is now 5, was a toddler. She was 1, I think, when we got our first cat. And toddlers are kind of like cats in that they have an if I fits, I sits mentality. You know, if you've seen memes with cats sitting in funny boxes, toddlers also have an if I fits, I sits, but it's very skewed. So I have a picture of Faith sitting at an American Girl picnic table eating a snack. She looks like a giant because she's literally just sitting on this picnic table and it's, you know, 4 inches off of the ground and she's a 30-pound toddler. So when we got the cat, we had to be very prescriptive in saying, you can't treat the cat in this way or you will hurt it. And we can come to the conclusion that you can't treat the cat in this way or you will hurt it by looking at the design of a cat. We believe that cats have a creator. We believe that they were designed with a particular purpose. And if you look at the size of the cat, if you look at the bone structure of the cat, if you look at how it is fuzzy and soft and cute and purrs, and if you look at its teeth, you can come to certain conclusions about what is a cat for. Cats are great companions. They're playful. Some cats like to sit on laps. There is a lot of evidence that I find we just had a kid squeal as though they were shocked, like scared around the corner. That's why.
Well, Tito came around the corner and scared, I think, Elise.
Yeah.
It's like, wah! And then Elise just burst out laughing.
Yeah. And laughing. It's good that she was laughing. Mm-hmm. So a cat, you know, there's evidence that cats only purr around human beings. Cats don't purr felines do not purr in the wild. Cats developed purring to somehow communicate with humans.
Didn't they develop? I think you told me this. They developed to meowing.
Cats in the wild make various sounds, but domestic cats meow in various intonations in ways that uniquely communicate with their human counterparts. They don't meow at each other. They hiss at each other. But they don't
growl at each
make
other.
These plaintive meows like our cats make specifically to us. So cats, even if you were to be a bit evolutionary in your understanding of a cat, you could look at a cat now and say cats currently are designed for human companionship. They're designed for catching pests with their teeth and their hunting instincts and all the things. They're designed for jumping and climbing trees based on looking at their haunches and their claws. You can make all of these conclusions about what a cat is for. You can also make conclusions based on the design about what a cat is not for. Just sort of like the American Girl table that the toddler was sitting on. I have a cute picture of her on it. And then I said, please get off of that table. It's not designed to hold a person. It's designed to hold a doll. You will break it. Likewise, you can't sit on a cat and pretend that it's a horse. You will break it. So coming from that, we've observed what a cat is for. We've observed what a cat is not for because of the consequences of using that. And by the way, I can end a sentence in a preposition now, according to Webster's. I can say what is a cat for and be grammatically correct.
I've been doing that for years. I still try not to because it just makes for better English, I think.
In this case, what is a cat for just rolls off your tongue better than for what is a cat? For what purpose is a cat?
True.
Or for
true.
What purpose does that. A cat exist?
Makes for better English, makes for smoother English, I guess.
Anyway, there was a World Watch on that too. And apparently there's a linguistic family reason for not ending in prepositions, like etymologically English didn't do that because of roots. So anyway, we can draw from our observation about purposes and reasons for cats to exist. We can then draw some moral conclusions that if you were to sit on a cat, you would hurt it. And we can say that would be wrong or bad. You are misusing a cat by not using it in a way that fits with its design. So we can draw a moral observation about how we treat cats. And then we can draw imperatives, which is don't sit on the cat. You should not sit on the cat. So we've gone from observing the design to making moral conclusions and imperatives. We can do the same thing with a human body. About relationships. We can look at the human body and say a man and a woman's body fit together like a lock and a key, and human babies that come from that one man, one woman union do best when being raised in the home of the father and the mother who are biologically related to them. Father and mother, chemically, in terms of like hormones and pheromones that are released in their bodies, bond with one another during a marital act and with their offspring when they are doing things that fathers and mothers are designed to do in interacting with their children. And so there seems to be data-wise, sociologically, as well as biologically, a design for a nuclear family. And if you violate that design, something is going to be broken, just like if you sit on a cat or on an American Girl table. Something's going to be broken. With women having sex outside of marriage, it's usually a cause for, well, it puts you at greater risk of STDs. Women are at greater risk than men in having extramarital sex. It puts you at tremendous risk for mental health crises. High school girls who are sexually active have significantly more mental health issues than girls who are not, and college girls. It also puts you at greater risk of, obviously, of having a child and then having to decide what to do with that child. And it also puts you at greater risk of relational difficulties in the future. So you have all of this.
And poverty.
Yes, it does actually put both men and women at risk of poverty. And almost certainly the children that come from that act. So there's all of this. This is all just data, right? But we can draw from that data a moral imperative that maybe we should be operating according to the design, which is don't have sex outside of marriage. And that don't have sex outside of marriage is what you would, I'm not, your parents and my parents are always like, you're always picking on how you grew up during the podcast.
Yeah.
And that's not true. We just have different information available to us now, which is when we were in high school, mm-hmm. I signed a True Love Waits card. You know,
True Love Waits was the jam.
Yeah. You know, and that's what we knew. We were entering an era of more sexual promiscuity in the culture, and the church was doing what it could, as best as it could, to try to equip parents.
The message is still the same. Sex outside of marriage is wrong.
But we can now say we have this moral imperative, and it comes from Scripture, and that Scripture is obviously good. But we also know that there is a design behind that to help us bolster the argument that the moral imperative has psychological and physical realities behind it, saying, just like if I tell my kids, don't let the toddler sit on the cat, there's a whole lot more weight behind it if we say, if you do, you could kill the cat, because cats are not designed to be sat upon. And here's all the data supporting that.
Do not sit upon the cat.
Cats, in most cases, are good for catching pests, unless it's our cat. Cats are not good for being sat upon. And that is the moral lesson for our class today, kids.
I think your metaphor works. The metaphor with the table for faith is also a really good metaphor. Use both. It kind of says the same thing in two different ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Throw it all in there
just
together.
Throw it all in there, just like you did. You'll be fine.
And
you're going to crush it.
Part of me was to like shorthand it and be like, and so kids, we've now learned from cats not to have sex outside of marriage. Anyway.
That's funny. All right. Well, we'll call it here, I guess, and put out a show hopefully next week. If you want to interact with us, the best way to do that is the aforementioned Telegram group. There's a link in the show notes, so jump on and join that. You can also head over to our website at Too Busy to Flush, all grammatically correct, toobusytoflush.com or TB, the number 2F, TB2F.com, and scroll all the way down and send us a postcard. While you're there, swing over to the Swag Shack and pick up a shirt or a hat or a sticker and help financially support our small little effort. We don't have a lot of overhead because, obviously, like I said, I'm an audio engineer. I own all the equipment for my other business, but there's still things like website hosting fees and podcast hosting fees and all those sorts of things. And then if we have a little extra, it's fun to like advertise and get new listeners. But that said, we are a weekly podcast, inconsistently weekly podcast. We try to put out a show a week, but we're not sure what day that's going to be, but that's the goal. So anyway, we will have next week's show, and then we'll be having no more shows for the rest of March because we're going to be on a family trip, those couple of weeks there. So we won't have a show in that intermediary time. So one more show, and then we'll kick things back off in April.
Right after Easter.
Yep. Right after Easter. So, that said, Molly, I don't have anything. Do you have anything?
I don't. Go make yourself some salmon sometime if you find a good price on salmon and want to try our mayonnaise recipe. And otherwise, we'll see you next week.